welcome to another installment of The Two Brandons. This is Brandon Thomas.
And this is Brandon Easton.
And today we are going to be talking about Iron Man 3, the recently released Marvel Studios blockbuster that follows up from the blockbuster Avengers movie of last summer, and also Iron Man 2 from a couple of years ago. We're going to talk about that and end with some discussion about the importance of film scores. And we're both a little obsessed with that, so that'll be a good pivot for us. And will allow us to talk about Iron Man 3, because, spoiler alert, I did like Iron Man 3, but I thought the score was lacking. So before we get too far into it, I would just like to, we'll have Mr. Easton give his impressions of Iron Man 3.
All right. Well, on my Facebook page, and for those who don't know, my Facebook is www.facebook.com/Brandon.Easton. If you're not a friend of mine yet, you should definitely join it, because I'm about to flip it over to being a fan page and then create a page just for me and my close family and friends. With that being said, I posted a my own review. It wasn't really expansive or a deep analysis, but I just gave a couple of bullet points about how I felt about Iron Man 3. And really, my feelings on Iron Man 3 have to do a lot more with my view of comic book movies right now. It seems that as Marvel, particularly Marvel, churns out more and more of its cinematic universe, a lot of the charm that drew us all into the Marvel Cinematic Universe is starting to disappear, and it feels like the movies are these corporate monoliths that are just set up to get people on opening weekend so they can boast about how much money it made, and then it would, you know, through curiosity and word of mouth, other people go see the movie based on that report, and it just kind of creates a domino effect of interest. But my issue is that the actual product isn't as compelling or as thought-provoking or emotionally resonant as I would hope it would be. And that's kind of my problem with Iron Man 3. And also, by extension, Iron Man 2 was the worst example, or the best example, of what I'm talking about in terms of corporate, like the corporate influence in superhero movie making. Now, I don't hate Iron Man 3. It sounds like I do. I don't want to see it again. I've had worse cinematic experiences. Iron Man 3 was not a horrible experience, but to me, it was ultimately a very, very forgettable experience. About an hour and a half after I left the theater, I didn't remember anything I saw. And my fear is that superhero movies and Hollywood movies in general are becoming these fast food visual experiences that are meant to titillate for short-term excitement and for short-term entertainment, but not meant to have any lasting effect on the psyche or the brain. And, you know, and my thoughts are basically this. You know, Robert Downey Jr. is always solid. I've never heard the phrase bad Robert Downey Jr. performance. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. He was good, but the Tony Stark, or his portrayal of Tony Stark in Iron Man 1 and in Avengers, is not present in Iron Man 3. I don't know if that was Robert Downey Jr. on screen the whole time, or if he was trying to be Tony Stark, or was he playing himself playing Tony Stark? I couldn't even figure out what performance that was. You know what I mean? Because Robert Downey Jr. is a sensational actor. He is a very good technical actor. He's very good at eliciting emotions with his face. But when he's not engaged, just like when Tom Cruise isn't engaged or when Will Smith isn't engaged in the material, they just kind of sleepwalk through the movie. And in a lot of ways, I feel that Robert Downey Jr. sleptwalked through Iron Man 3 in a lot of ways. Then, of course, we have another magnificent actor named Don Cheadle, who, as War Machine or Iron Patriot, and Iron Patriot is the dumbest name in the universe. I mean, I know that Norman Osborn used it during the Siege storyline, but good God, that is a dumb name.
And they turned it into a gag in the movie.
Obviously, because everyone knows that's a stupid name. So Don Cheadle, you know, he did more in Iron Man 3 than he did in Iron Man 2, but that's just like a baby taking five steps as opposed to three. You know, he did a little bit more this time around. that justified his paycheck and him being in the credits, but they did nothing with him. There's no arc with him. There was nothing done with Don Cheadle's character of James Rhodes. And the thing is, most people don't even call him James Rhodes. They call him Don Cheadle. You know what I mean? Like, when people say, oh, Don Cheadle was great in Iron Man 3, but do you even know his name? That, the sad thing is that no one even knows anything about War Machine still. We don't. I mean, if I wasn't a fan of comic books and a long-term reader of Marvel Comics, and I went to see the Iron Man universe and used as an example of what's going on in the Marvel universe, I would think that there was maybe one page a year dedicated to Don Cheadle's character of James Rhodes. Whereas we know that James Rhodes as War Machine, and he was actually the second Iron Man, you know, because back when Tony was drunk, back in the day in the Marvel Comics, James Rhodes became Iron Man for quite some time.
Yep.
And the big story back then was that he always wondered how people would react if they knew who it was actually under the armor. That was a great storyline. There's no reason why they couldn't have done that, but, you know, once again, this is just another example of wasting a really good actor in a role where I think he's just collecting a paycheck. And with that also being said, Don Cheadle nor did Terrence Howard look anything like James Rhodes. Now, I understand, because I'm really big on the idea of you can't always have a character look like the actor look like the comic book character. I understand that. I have no issue with that. But this was, like, egregiously bad casting. I mean, it was awful. Terrence Howard not only does not look like James Rhodes, but doesn't sound like or behave like or think like him. And Don Cheadle is about, I'd say, 6 inches too short to play James Rhodes. They could have gotten Morris Chestnut or maybe Michael Jai White, who, while those two don't have as big of names as Don Cheadle or Terrence Howard, which is all that really counts in Hollywood.
Right. Essentially, you know, yes.
You know, which is all that really counts. I mean, we all know this. But there's a certain lack of physicality that Don Cheadle has where it makes it very difficult to take him seriously as an action hero. He just doesn't look the part. He's horribly miscast. I mean, it would be as the same as if you put Bill Cosby in the War Machine armor. I mean, Bill Cosby's a great actor, but he's just not right for the role.
I mean, I don't think Don Cheadle is that. I would argue that that's not quite the same thing. I mean, I don't think that Don Cheadle is so unphysical that, you know, you could replace him with Bill Cosby or, you know, Cat Williams or something, and it would be the same thing.
But no, I'm being facetious. I'm just messing around.
Yeah.
But the reality is, I just don't feel Don Cheadle was the right person for James Rhodes or War Machine. Now, my real issue in terms of casting is Gwyneth Paltrow as Pepper Potts. Now, I know why they cast her. Once again, she's skinny. She's America pretty. What I mean by America pretty is blonde and thin and has that Midwestern, you know, kind of blank expression that everybody seems to love. She, in my mind, is a charisma vacuum on every conceivable level. I don't think I've liked any performance she's ever given in the history of performances I've seen from Gwyneth Paltrow. I like most actors, because most actors, by virtue of being actors, have a certain level of charisma, or else they wouldn't be stars, right? But there's two people on Earth I don't understand why they are stars. One of them is Jennifer Aniston, and the second one is Gwyneth Paltrow. These are two of the least compelling people I've ever seen in my entire life who've been given these remarkable careers. And I know that, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow is a legacy because her mother is an actress named Blythe Danner. And if you don't know who that is, she was the mother in the Meet the Parents movie. She was Robert De Niro's wife. That's Gwyneth Paltrow's mom. And her father, Bruce Paltrow, I think that's his name. He was a film director. So she got in because she's a legacy. I don't know how Jennifer Aniston got into anything. But anyway, Gwyneth Paltrow is Pepper Potts. I mean, the use of her in this movie is absurd. It not only stretches credibility, it's just such a obvious marketing tactic to get female viewers to care about the Marvel Universe. Instead of just making a movie with strong female characters, because Marvel has a overload of incredible female superheroes. I mean, they really do. But they use Gwyneth Paltrow to and then put the armor on her and that. When I saw that, I didn't know what to think. I honestly believed that I was hallucinating. I thought that maybe something in popcorn, and I tuned out. I was like, okay, they put the armor on her. She's been in the armor more than Don Cheadle has. You know what I mean? And I'm thinking to myself, this is just it's a travesty. This putting her in this movie, if you could put anybody else in that movie other than her or Jennifer Aniston, and I wouldn't have had a problem with her performance. And there are plenty of more beautiful and talented actresses out there who could have been Pepper Potts. Keeping her in this franchise, to me, is just one of the biggest mistakes that the producers made. And man. And then, I guess we can go into spoilers now.
Oh, yeah. We'll tag it and make sure everybody knows.
And I'm saying now I am going to give a couple of huge spoilers from the movie. So, I hate to say this, but if you're listening and you haven't seen the movie, which is doubtful, you might not want to go too much past this point, or you might want to come back and fast forward to a little bit later. And we probably will put it in the notes at what point do the spoilers begin and end with a minute count. So I think that'll probably be a good idea for listeners who haven't seen the movie yet. So with that said, I'm going to get into spoilers. 3, 2, 1. Now, the revelation of the Mandarin being a puppet did not bother me at all. I thought Ben Kingsley was absolutely hilarious. In fact, he was the bright spot to that movie. And the theme that corporations are creating terrorism in order to justify military spending is absolutely brilliant. And they just kind of poo-pooed on that. They could have really made the whole movie about that idea. That is one of the most core concepts that people believe nowadays. After September 11th and after the Iraq War, a lot of people became aware suddenly of the fact that weapons manufacturers and defense contractors have a great deal of power in D.C. People apparently had no idea about this, but the Iraq War...
Which is ridiculous.
But you know what? A lot of Americans generally have this belief that the government is infallible. Even all the Tea Party wackos and fakers, a lot of people generally give the government the benefit of the doubt. I don't know why they do, but they do. So with that said, the Occupy Wall Street, and a friend of mine said this, Occupy Wall Street was white kids realizing that the government considers them niggers too. You know what I mean? That's what Occupy Wall... That's why there were no black people there at Occupy, because they were like, we already been there.
You're just now understanding this?
Right, but the thing is that the elites... And I'm going to get, not only get to be a little bit, but like the thing is, the people who run everything don't care about anybody, regardless of race, class, or gender. And the majority of white Americans, I feel, still think that they're part of this big, giant tapestry. And then the Iraq War, the defense contract and commodification side of the Iraq War woke everybody up into being like, whoa, nobody cares about us. So that concept in the movie, which was also very much a part of Iron Man 1.
Yes.
Jeff Bridges' character, you know, being the defense contractor doing dirt behind Tony's back, that is still a great concept, and that's something that Marvel did. Who was writing it back then? David Michelinie? I think Bob Layton and David Michelinie were dealing with that back when you had the evil Stain Corporation and when they were dealing with Roxxon Energy as well as AIM, which is Advanced Idea Mechanics, which was really cool to see all these things mentioned in this movie, but they did nothing with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, AIM, for those who don't read Marvel Comics long term, basically, you know how in Star Wars you have all those troopers with the in the stormtrooper outfits, and you don't know what they look like, and you just blow them away and, you know, knock them over? The Marvel Comics version of Star Wars stormtroopers are AIM soldiers. AIM soldiers have these bright yellow hazmat suits with like bucket heads, and the Avengers and the Hulk and the Fantastic Four and everybody have been beating those guys up for like 30 years, you know, and it would have been cool to see those yellow costumes get beat up, but of course we didn't get that because, you know, we didn't go in that direction because they'd rather deal with the foolishness of Pepper Potts and this bastardized version of the extremist storyline which is actually a pretty good storyline.
Yes.
But you wouldn't know that by what they did with the lava people. That's what I call them, the lava people. Iron Man 3. And the Mandarin, and I said this on Facebook, nobody knows who the Mandarin is.
No.
Ask one in, let's say, 5 million people. Who the man? Maybe one in 5 million will know who the Mandarin is. I've been reading comic books since 1981, and I don't know that much about the Mandarin other than the fact he has these 12 power rings, and they all do something different. And they're like magical, and he's Asian, and that looks like a Fu Manchu stereotype.
Right.
That's the only thing I know about the Mandarin. All the geeks online have been whining and saying, oh, they did this to the Mandarin. I'm like, you don't care about
who cares about the Mandarin. I mean, that was my impression of you know, having to read those complaints. I'm like, seriously, who gives a shit about the Mandarin? Like, that is
you should title this podcast "Who Gives a Crap About the Mandarin."
I mean, that the Mandarin is so inside baseball that it's unbelievable to me. I mean, the general public doesn't know anybody but the Joker, Lex right. Luthor, who else? Maybe General Zod, because he was in the second Superman movie. But as far as, you know, big-time villains go, that the average person on the street would know, the Mandarin is not one of them. And, you know, like you said, I didn't have a huge problem with how they chose to portray the Mandarin. The thing that I was kind of disappointed about was, I don't know if you noticed, maybe if you weren't obsessing over the trailers like I was, there was a lot of really cool Mandarin dialogue and Mandarin monologues that didn't actually make the movie. And I don't know if they were initially in a preliminary cut of the movie and they got cut out completely, or if they just recorded a special voiceover for the trailers and ads to make it seem like the Mandarin was far more important than he actually turned out to be. Right. I think I like the movie probably a little more, possibly a lot more than you, but I can understand why some people didn't like it. To me, I liked it, but like I said on Facebook, I didn't Avengers like it. I mean, I wasn't in love with, you know, 75% of the thing. I believe that it had some moments. I believe that there was, like you said, there were kernels of a few cool stories there, but a lot of it didn't get fully developed. A lot of things just kind of happened, and you thought something was going to happen with them later, and they didn't. But I mean, to me, that's really epitomized by the fact that they cut. Like, if you go back and like check out all of those Iron Man 3 trailers, there's this entire thing where the Mandarin is like talking to and taunting Tony Stark, and none of that was in the movie.
Right.
And I was really surprised that they spent so much time either, you know, faking that for the ads, or that they had cut so much out of the movie. I just, like, to me, it seemed like there was just a slight lack of commitment to things. I mean, yes. if the fear was that, you know, we don't want to spend too much time developing the Mandarin, because then when we get to the twist, the audience will feel even more betrayed by what they've seen. Where to me, I think that the audience should have felt more betrayed by what they had seen. You know, they really didn't give us a lot to really be upset about. I mean, unless you're a comics fan and you're freaking out about the Mandarin. I mean, just someone that sits down to watch that movie, I don't think they were terribly upset that the Mandarin turned out to be a fraud, because there was so little done with him leading up to that point that it was like, well, right, you know, who cares? They obviously want this movie to be about, you know, Killian and AIM, you know, so that's fine. So to me, it was a kind of a lack of commitment to certain ideas that I didn't like. I mean, I didn't like the fact that they cut all that Mandarin dialogue out. I mean, I wanted to see Mandarin on TV taunting Tony Stark, making fun of him. It was like, after after Tony Soot rescued him from, you know, from the bay or whatever and flew him out to Tennessee by mistake, all we saw was that there was a newspaper article that was like, we think Tony Stark is dead, which just, when you think about it, it's really hard to do, because when you start thinking about any of these movies and picking them apart, you have to accept that they don't really make sense. You know, you just kind of want them to have an internal logic, and it seems like that was something that was even lacking from this one. I mean, after he blew up Tony's house, I want the Mandarin on TV making fun of Tony Stark, laughing at him. I mean, and I didn't get any of that. It was just like, oh, well, yeah, you know, we blew up your house and you might be dead, so whatever. And it was just funny to me how even though, I don't know if they were trying to say something about, you know, the South or, you know, the middle of America, but the fact that nobody recognized that Tony Stark was wandering around Tennessee. I mean, this is post-Avengers. Tony Stark cannot walk around any part of, they have TVs in Tennessee. I mean, there's no way in the world that one of the Avengers is just walking around without his suit. Right. And nobody knows who he is because, you know, he has a cap on. I mean, you know, he sits down, he has conversations with people. He had an entire conversation with that woman about her son, and she didn't say, hey, you know what? You look a lot like this dude on the TV they're talking about might be dead.
Everything you're saying, I agree with. I was laughing because it felt like not only did he go to Tennessee, but he went to 1985 Tennessee in an episode of Knight Rider.
Oh, like backlot Tennessee, like if Tennessee.
Well, no, it was like there were several episodes of Knight Rider where Michael ended up in like some backwater place without Kit, and some precocious teenager was like his helper and kept quipping with him the entire time. And I thought to myself, why am I watching 1985 versions of like an action TV show, like Airwolf or A-Team, you know, or Hardcastle and McCormick? This is like television stuff. This is not big Marvel movie stuff. Like, where in God's name in Iron Man 1 did you have a scene like that? You just wouldn't.
I mean, look, on the surface of it, I don't object to them, you know, saying, hey, you know what would be cool? What if we had, like, the superhero in the small town and his suit's messed up?
That was called Thor.
That's true. They also did that with Thor. I guess that's also true. But, I mean, there are certain things in the movie that just didn't really follow. It didn't really follow through, and it didn't really commit to anything. I mean, right. I think they should have killed Happy Hogan. I mean, I'm sorry, Jon Favreau. I know that, you know, you got to do the thing where you star in the movies and you directed the first couple, and I don't know if it would be like a cruel joke to have the first Iron Man movie he doesn't direct for him to die in. But the fact that, you know, they just kind of blew him up and then he was fine by the end, and watching Downton Abbey, it was kind of you know, it just seemed very, very kind of vanilla and sterilized in certain ways. And it's just hard for me to believe that after what happened in Iron Man 2 or what happened in the Avengers, that Tony Stark wouldn't have some kind of contingency plan for what would happen if somebody just came to his house and blew it up. I mean, that was a possibility that was being floated in the last movie. I mean, the last movie, Rhodes had to take a suit away from him because the government wanted, didn't they had a line that said, you know, the government wants to march tanks up the road and take your suits. So the fact that Tony Stark really has no plan at all for what might happen if somebody comes up to his house and tries to take his stuff away just seems kind of silly. I mean, it goes a little past, you know, Tony Stark is just, you know, an arrogant bastard and doesn't believe anybody can, you know, ever take him down. And it just kind of makes it silly. I mean, Rhodes doesn't come look for him after the Mandarin blows up his house. I mean, Rhodes doesn't even show up in his suit and try to help. I mean, it just, you know, it's like you'd be watching the movie and you'd be thinking, hey, whatever happened to James Rhodes? And then they would cut to a scene to show him what he was doing, show what he was doing. And then you were like, wait a minute, what happened to Pepper and Maya? And then they would cut to a scene and show what they were doing. But it right, just, exactly. it was very disjointed. And it's right. kind of one of those things where one of my kind of cardinal sins is just where you sacrifice character for plot. And I feel that there was, a lot of that, kind of weaved throughout the movie. Now, that said, there were some things that I liked about it.
Skydive?
What?
The skydive?
Oh, the skydive was awesome. I thought that was a very well-executed scene. I thought, emotionally, even though they didn't, I don't think they really kind of really carried it through. I did like this idea that Tony Stark is feeling very small and damaged and inferior in light of his, experience in the Avengers. Now, emotionally, like, I think that rang true and that made sense. Now, was that kind of carried through all the way through the movie in the greatest way possible? I don't think so, but I did like that as an idea. I liked some of the weird kind of subtleties of it. I love the opening scene where you got to see where he met Jensen. I know that mm-hmm. was just kind of like a wink to the audience. I thought that was pretty great. I thought that the post-credits sequence, that kind of aped the style of probably some of those TV shows you were talking about. I thought that was pretty cool and well done. And the post-credit sequence that kind of really tied everything together where, Bruce Banner shows up was also pretty cool too. So again, like you, I don't want to make it sound like I hated the movie because I didn't hate the movie at all. I mean, I would go see it again, maybe in IMAX or something, maybe not 3D, but I do think that I do think that it was pretty solid. I do think that it was a little more coherent than Iron Man 2 was. I think it's important that they feel like that Marvel Studios feels like they can take some risk and not just try to deliver the same movie experience over and over again, which I think is going to get them. Is going to get them into trouble long term. I liked that the Avengers was mentioned and referenced and moved on from. There weren't a lot of, cutaways to Avengers showing, remember what happened in New York? But I think that there were some things that it did great. I think that there were some things it did not so great. And overall, I think it was... it was satisfying, even though they're kind of pretending that like this may be the last Iron Man, which you shouldn't believe for a second, but it was what it was to me. I mean, like I said, obviously we did a podcast specifically about movies, and this was my number one movie. I expect to like other movies more than this one? I hope so. But, will this be on my top five list by the time the summer is over? Hopefully. maybe we should do one at the end of the summer and redo
that's
the,
a good idea.
And redo the list in the real order. So I thought it did some things that were cool. I mean, I liked the mind powered suit. The thing that they did with Pepper was fine to me, but again, I wish that I almost wish that they had just adapted the Five Nightmares storyline that Matt Fraction did when he started Invincible Iron Man. I think that was a great storyline. And in that storyline, Pepper Potts is injured and Tony gives her, like the repulsor in her chest, like him. And she does get her own suit of armor. So I think that might have played a little better than the whole, she gets captured and injected with extremis stuff. Mm-hmm. Just because in the comic, you know, that's what happens to Tony. So I could see, I mean, if you look at it, you can see them taking all of these, this mishmash of parts from all of these different comics and stories and kind of just flipping them around and turning them into something else. I mean, War Machine, I don't think that at this point, I don't think that we should hope for anything more to be done with right. War Machine, unless War Machine gets his own movie.
Which he won't.
Which he won't. And I think that War Machine is just going to be a supporting character in these movies to show up and, like, make faces at Tony and say something kind of funny and shoot. So, you know, I mean, I think that that's all we can expect. And to be honest, I mean, honestly, when you look at it, the Mandarin, you know, according to comics fans, is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Iron Man villain. So look what they decided to do with that character. Now ask yourself, what do you expect to happen with James Rhodes going forward? I mean, if they're willing, and again, I'm not, you know, saying that they shouldn't have made that decision, but given the fact that they did with what is the premier Iron Man villain, you know, to nerds anyway, given the fact they were willing to do something so outrageous and so off the page there, I mean, do you really think that we're going to get much character development for Rhodey? I mean, it's just, it doesn't make any sense. It's not going to happen. I mean, if you're watching the movies, you just know it's not going to happen. The fact that they just took his suit and just painted it and then made fun of how stupid the new name was. It, you know, I mean, there people ask a lot of questions about stuff, but the answers are right there, but they don't like what the answers are. So it turns right. into, you know, well, why don't they do more with Rhodey? Like, because they don't care about Rhodey, because Rhodey is a supporting character. Rhodey is not going to be in Avengers. There's not going to be a War Machine movie. It's just not going to happen. So, you know, that said, if you haven't seen Iron Man 3, I encourage everybody to go see it and make up their own mind about it. I mean, even though I didn't feel, you know, great about it, and I know a lot of people didn't feel great about it, I'm a big proponent of, in most cases, maybe not Tyler Perry movies, but, you know, go see it and watch it and make up your own mind, you know, regarding what you feel about it. Don't just, you know, because I think people kind of read this stuff, they read these reviews, and they kind of just absorb it, and it becomes this hive mind where, you know, everyone hates the movie for the same reasons, where I think everyone right. should hate it for different reasons, but,
exactly.
you know, that are entirely personal to them. So I would encourage you to go see the movie. It's not a bad movie, but it's not a great movie. I don't think it rose to the level of the Avengers, storytelling wise, and kind of like cool moment wise. I mean, some of the effects are a little interesting, but this whole idea, this rumor that, you know, Joss Whedon was so intimidated by Iron Man 3 that, you know, he's like pulling his hair out. That doesn't seem to be true, given what I saw in the movie. I mean, the action in the Avengers is much more complex and intricate than it is in Iron Man 3. So I think they'll be just fine.
Well, with that, you know, you summed up a lot of how I feel. And another thing I'm going to say about it is I don't get how those suits made it from Malibu, California to Miami, Florida in about 3 minutes. They would have had to go about 10,000 miles an hour. Because, no, I mean, people don't, I mean, I was sitting there thinking about this as I was watching it, and the suits launch off out of Tony's ruined building. They cross the entire country in about 3 minutes. And I didn't realize Iron Man suits could go 10,000 miles an hour.
I mean, I don't know. I can't remember. I'll pay more attention to it the next time I see it. How long it actually took the...
It was about 3 minutes.
Well, no. How long it took the gauntlet in the boot to get to him from Tennessee. Because if... because... If you're,
I forgot all about that.
Well, no, crap. But see, if you're going by that logic, then the boot and the gauntlet should have reached him in Miami in what, like 30, 45 seconds, maybe?
Pretty much, yeah.
Which just seems to me, I mean, I know Tony Stark is the man. I know he's a genius, but it seems like he can make a lot more money building jets that can take you across the country in 3 minutes than he ever did making weapons.
Well, I'm going to get even more nitpicky.
Okay.
Those suits seem to be approaching from the east, and okay, California's west of Miami, so... Okay. I don't know how that happened. Unless they went around the world the opposite way at 20,000 miles an hour.
I don't know. Maybe there was a wormhole.
I'm thinking it had to be some kind of hole because there's a big logic hole in this movie. And speaking of Tony Stark's house, and I'm going to try to wrap it up because I can go on for about another hour about what I didn't like about this movie. You think that helicopters with missiles would not really pose too much of a challenge? Like, wouldn't he have automatic defense systems, or at least a better warning than Jarvis telling him 10 seconds too late that armed helicopters are floating right toward directly toward the house?
I mean, apparently Tony Stark has no plan for anything like that, because these people just show up, they just blow up his house and bury his suits, and he has to wait for a bunch of guys in a crane to dig out all of his suits from inside the floor. And I, just those little things that just kind of, they just don't make that much sense. I mean, if this dude is so terrified and so affected by what has happened to him, you would think that he would have maybe made two less suits and worried about some defensive capabilities on his mansion so they couldn't just roll up on him and just blow the thing into the water without right, him having any chance of stopping him. Like, maybe Iron Man only needed 39 suits instead of 42, and maybe you should have got some kind of early detection system. But, I mean, like I said, we could do this forever. I mean, you could do any of these movies you can take and you can just right, pick apart. I mean, even the ones that people consider to be great. Like, I mean, I like the first Iron Man, but I don't think I love the first Iron Man as much as everybody else, which is why I think I was a little more forgiving with the second one. I think, the final battle with Tony and Obadiah, I thought was pretty lame and not really well choreographed. But, we're getting off topic. So anyway, Iron Man 3, some of it you'll like, some of it you'll dislike, but overall, I would definitely recommend people to see it just for the spectacle of it and to kind of make up your own mind about it.
Right. And to put my capper on it, I think the things that I really look for in any movie, I don't care, because the thing is, I don't do what a lot of movie critics do. I will give a superhero movie the same consideration as I would a movie that people consider to be critically acclaimed. Mm-hmm. So if Iron Man 3 is on the market, I'm not going to put, let's say, Great Expectations, which also had Gwyneth Paltrow in it, the most recent one, or a movie like The Descendants with George Clooney, or a movie like Children of a Lesser God. Yes, those are dramas dealing with serious topics, but all movies should have the same thing to make them work, and I believe that's clarity of character, connecting a character's arc with a thematic premise of the movie, which was done extremely well in X-Men First Class with Magneto's arc. And you have to have something called emotional resonance. Without any of those three, movies generally don't work. And Iron Man 3 does not really have any kind of thematic tie to his character arc. And I don't know if there was a character arc for Tony in Iron Man 3, because if blowing up his suits at the end is some kind of character resolution, then I wasted my time completely.
I believe that was the character resolution, by the way.
Yeah, and that's the problem. And that
Tony Stark realizing that he is not his suits, that he is Iron Man, and that he doesn't need them to protect him and shield him from the rest of the world. Or from his own emotions, blah, blah, blah. The end.
There you go. All right. Now, let's move to Oblivion, which was released a few weeks ago. And it did okay. So far, internationally, it's only made $222 million, which, you know, sad to say, isn't exactly a hit. But it is, I think it's the 20th movie that Tom Cruise has been in that has grossed over $200 million. So that's a pretty, crazy. Yeah, if you think about that, that's pretty insane. Oblivion was a story that I felt was very well done. I saw Oblivion recently, and I still remember a whole lot of the movie. There are emotional cues in the movie that still resonate with me even after the point. It has been criticized for having a very thin plot, but I don't think a movie like Oblivion is just about the typical ABC story development. It reminded me of a Russian film that was remade by Steven Soderbergh a few years ago with George Clooney again. It was a movie called Solaris, and it was released in 1972 by a Russian filmmaker named Tartakovsky, I believe that's his name.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a movie about how the universe, the physical universe, and the universe of memory can become one and the same once human beings get past their trappings of flesh and matter. And that's something that Yoda said in the middle of Empire Strikes Back, where he says, "Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter." That concept is very much a part of Oblivion. And I love the idea that memory and love and idea can be transposed despite all obstacles in the way. The main character, which was, his name was Jack Harper, which I thought it was funny because he just did a movie where he was Jack Reacher. You know, I was like, okay, what's going on here with the Jack, you know? But, and Oblivion, I don't want to ruin it for those who haven't seen it because there are a couple of twists in there. And
yeah, we won't ruin this one.
Right. One of the things I'll say about Oblivion, I didn't see a lot of the events coming. There are moments in it which are ridiculously formulaic, and you can see them coming a mile away, like Morgan Freeman.
Right.
But so much of the film was so Kubrickian, in a sense, like Stanley Kubrick's work. He wants you to sit there and look at the image and take in all the little things around you. And there are many shots in Oblivion where you just get a chance to sit still and look at things. And that's something you don't really see in modern science fiction movies. They'll have a lot of special effects, but the camera's constantly jumping around. In Oblivion, there were quite a few shots where it was just quiet. And that, to me, was amazing, because we don't get quiet anything in any movie. I mean, really, think about it. There are not a whole lot of quiet science fiction movies that are big budget, like spectaculars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the budget for Oblivion was $120 million. And you saw every penny of that on the screen.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I found out, that much of the backgrounds that weren't shot in Louisiana or shot in Iceland were actually digitally composited from a bunch of different sources. I did not know that. I did all this research on the movie over the last couple of nights because I was like, this is just amazing, you know? And the director, Joseph Kosinski, he also did Tron Legacy, and he's also a computer animator of great skill and talent. And what he did with this is make a massive step in his own career as a visual storyteller. Not only was he able to get a pretty decent performance out of Tom Cruise and the supporting cast, other than Morgan Freeman, and also Jaime Lannister, the Kingslayer, is in it from Game of Thrones, but he only has about three lines in the entire movie, so he was also wasted along with Morgan Freeman. But otherwise, I didn't see the end coming. I thought it was really cool. And there were a couple of moments when I was sitting there like, I can't believe I'm looking at this. This is a really gorgeous moment. And compared to the visual bombast and directorial muddiness of Iron Man 3, Oblivion, it's like having a very fine steak with a nice glass of red wine. You just sit there and you enjoy it. And you just take it in slow. You don't rush it. You don't, you know, gobble it up with a Big Mac. You just enjoy the experience. And I think that once we get through 2013, I really believe that Oblivion is one of the finest science fiction films of 2013 thus far. And I think that it's going to – I think it was released probably 3 weeks too early, but I'm glad it didn't get lost in the maelstrom of all the big-budget movies, other big-budget movies of the summer. So in my mind, I strongly recommend, wholeheartedly recommend, checking out Oblivion while you can see it on a big screen, because I can tell you now, Oblivion will be one of those movies that if you watch it on a small screen, you're going to lose 80% of the experience. That movie is meant to be seen and digested on as big a screen as you possibly can see it on. And that's my take on that.
All right. Well, I also saw Oblivion a few weeks ago, and I don't think I liked it quite as much as Brandon did. However, as he said, the movie is gorgeous. I mean, the set design, the effects, the weapons. I mean, everything is really, really cool looking, really well designed, and it's just, you know, it's eye candy. And as Brandon said, there is a patience to the storytelling that a lot of big budget sci-fi movies don't have. Iron Man 3 has no patience for anything, and you know, Oblivion almost has too much patience. But Oblivion's I think is a decent movie. It looks great. The score is fantastic. We're gonna come back to that in a second. And the only kind of issue I had with Oblivion, without giving everything away, was to me it felt like a cover band to me. Like it was kind of taking a bunch of different ideas from other really popular, really successful sci-fi movies and kind of smashed them together and kind of changed the background elements of it. So I didn't think that it was the most original piece of science fiction, but I do think that there is a lot to it. It looks great, and like I said, the soundtrack is phenomenal. And yesterday I posted on my Facebook that I think one of the critical failings of the, you know, kind of the Marvel Studios universe is a boring, uninspired film scores. And yeah. I think that, you know, personally, I am obsessed with film music. I mean, I write to it a lot. I have an entire, you know, I have an entire playlist that is just film scores, Pete Rock and Ninth Wonder instrumentals. I mean, like I just treasure this playlist, you know, more than anything else that I have in my music collection. And again, with Iron Man 3, the music is just very, I mean, it gets the job done, but that's pretty much it. I mean, I don't leave Marvel Studios productions typically and run home and buy the soundtrack to that movie. And
right.
I think it contributes to this kind of like mainstream kind of candy pop rocks kind of movies that Marvel wants to make. And not to say that they shouldn't make it, because obviously these movies make money and make it more easy, you know, make it easier for them to keep doing these movies if people keep going to see them. But I think that there is just, you know, kind of a lack of, I don't want to say artistry, I think that's too strong of a word, but to me, there's just something about image being paired with that right music cue, with the right piece of music to really send it over the top for me. And all of my favorite movies, I mean, with the exception of Bad Boys, but technically you could argue that that has an interesting film score, for some reason I have that, but any movie that I really, really, really love tends to have great music. And as an example, I guess Hans Zimmer released a track from the upcoming Man of Steel feature. He released a pure instrumental of the music track that's on the back of the latest trailer. And 3 minutes. This music clip is 3 minutes, and this piece of music is so exciting and so exhilarating that it's like, man, this dude just like killed the score to Iron Man 3 in 3 minutes. Like, how does that happen? You know, right. I can't remember any piece of music from Iron Man 3, with the exception of the kind of refrain that they use on the credit sequence at the end. I can't recall any, like, I'm not humming, you know, any piece of that film score. And I think that that's something that, to me, diminishes the final product just a little bit in my eyes, whether that's fair or not.
Well, you're not wrong, man. I think that music is so vitally important to the cinematic experience because, as I was told in film school many years ago, cinema is the synthesis of all art forms, the theatrical, the technical, and the lyrical. In this case, most film scores produced, particularly for superhero movies, tend to be the same cookie-cutter Alan Silvestri ripoff from the Lethal Weapon 1 soundtrack.
Alan Silvestri did the Avengers.
Right, and the thing is that if you listen to the Lethal Weapon score, and a lot of Alan Silvestri stuff, it is remarkably repetitive in some ways, and he's an amazing, what do you call it?
Composer.
Composer. But you see these cues, and these same action cues that pop up over and over and over again, and to me, it takes away from the experience because I feel like emotionally I've had this experience before, and music is not supposed, film scores are supposed to make you feel something other than just what you're seeing. You know what I mean? You're supposed to have a connection once, and it goes back to the phrase emotional resonance. If a film score cannot stir emotion, then it has not done its job. Yeah. When I was watching Oblivion, there were some really incredible moments. I mean, the part when he goes to the house by the lake the very first time,
uh-huh.
And before he puts on the Led Zeppelin song, you know, there's some music playing, and it's really beautiful stuff. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of relaxed me. It put me in the mood to watch what the next scene was going to be, if you know what I'm saying.
Right.
And when you think about the great music scores by Jerry Goldsmith, or by Ennio Morricone, or by John Williams. The reason why they stick out is because they do something for you. They affect you. They enhance the scene that they're in. I always give the example of Luke Skywalker looking at the twin sunset,
yep,
in the first Star Wars movie. If you had put any other music other than what John Williams put in that scene, it simply would not have worked. And if you try to watch that scene with the sound off, it simply does not work.
There's nothing to it.
Right. That music tells you everything you need to know about the character, his aspirations. And I got to hand it to Mark Hamill. He does visually in his face show his desperation and longing for just adventure. But the music makes it a synthesis of all arts. And Marvel, the producers of Marvel Studios and the producers at Paramount and the producers at Disney. And Disney shocked me because Disney has had a long track record of producing remarkable music for their,
yes,
movies. Whether I like those movies or not, the music sticks out and what stays in your head forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the most racist movies of all time, Song of the South, has one of the most singable songs in the history of mankind, which is zippity-doo-da, zippity-yay, my oh my, what a wonderful day. You know, but it's sung by a guy who's kind of happy being a slave. But the point being is that that song is so incredible. It has stuck with me from the first time I heard it all those years ago.
Yeah.
Now, I'm trying to think of a Marvel movie that I've seen that had a score that I thought about after I saw the movie. And honestly, I can't think of a Marvel movie where the score stuck out in any way, shape, or form. In fact, the only comic book movies that have memorable scores are the DC ones.
Yes.
Because the Dark Knight trilogy has had Hans Zimmer, who, you know, quite literally is amazing. And before that, used to have the leitmotif created by Danny Elfman for the 1989,
yep,
Batman movie,
mm-hmm,
that was redefined by Shirley Walker,
yes,
for Batman the Animated
Series.
I have
all of those CDs. There's a record label called La La Land Records. I have. Man, I was walking through San Diego Comic-Con. I think it was last year, possibly the year before, and I was right. really out of the loop for some reason, because usually I am on top of this. And several years ago, this same company put out a volume one for of music from Batman the Animated Series. It quickly sold out. And for years, people have been asking them to, you know, reprint this CD. And they're like, well, we want to. We just have to have, you know, Warner Brothers and DC approve it. So fast forward to San Diego Comic-Con last year. And I'm just walking, you know, like you do at Comic-Con, just walking. And I see La La Land's booth. And they have not only a fresh new pressing of Volume 1, but they also had Volume 2. Like, this was like my moment of the entire show. Like, this is the most important thing that happened at that show for me. Even when I was signing, I was on panels. But walking past that table and seeing that there were, like, four discs crammed with music. When I say crammed, I mean every single disc is, like, 74, 75 minutes of music from Batman the Animated Series. And that is some of my favorite stuff ever. So, I mean, I bought that stuff so fast. I had a Kool-Aid smile on my face for the rest of the afternoon.
And what I was going to say in regards to that, La La Land Records, I've also been a big proponent of them. And you know what's even better than Batman the Animated Series TV show soundtrack? Is the Batman the Mask of the Phantasm soundtrack, which was the animated movie that Shirley Walker did also did the music for. Now, Shirley Walker's work on Mask of the Phantasm is a lot more complex because it's dealing with a bunch of different stuff. And, you know, obviously, if you've seen Mask of the Phantasm by now, you know that it actually was the only time in the animated universe where you saw Bruce talk to his parents at their grave. And he also renounced the mantle or the cape and cowl because he wanted to fall in love and have a real life. And the music that's playing, you know, under that scene is some of the best music I've ever heard in my life composed for anything, regardless of animation or live action. If you're listening to this and if you have not yet seen Batman Mask of the Phantasm, you need to go get that in any format you can find it. I think you can stream it on I think it was available on Netflix for a while, but it may be on Hulu now. It is simply one of the greatest superhero films ever made, and it is accompanied by probably definitely the greatest animated film score I've ever heard in my entire life.
Yes.
Period. And I bought that from La La Land Records, and as I'm a Star Trek fan, I mentioned this to Brandon earlier, the Star Trek the Motion Picture from 1979, there has always been issues regarding the full soundtrack because the movie is quite long, yet all the music has never been fully released. Until now, La La Land Records has a box set that not only has the full score from Star Trek the Motion Picture, but it also has the unused tracks and the temp scores on separate discs. And the idea of that being available in any format is just extraordinary. And it's also, once again, by Jerry Goldsmith, who is quite literally also one of the greatest film composers of all time. The Star Trek The Next Generation score, the intro for the TV show, actually is the intro music for Star Trek The Motion Picture. And if you ever want to hear, if you ever want to hear that original, big, full orchestra version of that theme, all you got to do is pop in, you know, the Star Trek The Motion Picture 1979 soundtrack, and you'll hear it fully uncut. It is just magical, and it's transcendental. And these are not words that you usually hear me use in any description, but the scores of Jerry Goldsmith, particularly for Star Trek, are literally transcendental and magical. I would also recommend scores by James Horner, who's also another amazing composer, who did, I believe, the music for Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which, if you've ever heard it, you know that is some of the most beautiful music ever composed for a movie. And, you know, there's something to say about the music, you know, and Danny Elfman, of course, who used to be in Oingo Boingo, I have a great Oingo Boingo story. You know, actually, everybody should know this by now, but in the movie Back to School, with Rodney Dangerfield, there's a scene when they go to a bar. Oh, no, they have the scene where there's a band in his apartment, and the band singing Dead Man's Party is Oingo Boingo. The lead singer of Oingo Boingo is Danny Elfman, and you will see him in that scene singing the song Dead Man's Party. I just think that was great, the fact that he transitioned from a new wave weirdo pop band into being one of the greatest film composers in modern history.
Awesome. Awesome, awesome. But yeah, man, I mean, I could, you know, I'm sure you guys don't want to hear us talk about it all day, but I could talk about it all day. I mean,
Daft Punk did a great job on Tron Legacy.
Oh my God. Tron Legacy, the soundtrack for that movie made the movie better, I contend. I believe that if that movie had a more average, boring Marvel Studios-style soundtrack, that I don't think many people would feel anything about Tron Legacy. I mean, I listened to that soundtrack on repeat for months. It's one of my favorite things. That, I'm still really fond of the Inception soundtrack by Hans Zimmer.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Especially that last track, In Time. I mean, I don't want to, you know, I guess we could talk about this at another point, but there's like a point in Inception, like, where, like, my eye kind of messed it up on me, and a lot of that is because of that music track that was laid over the scene. I mean, I think it is so, so important, and I think it's the difference between, you know, a good movie and a great movie. And going forward, I mean, I would just like to see Marvel Studios take a more interested hand. And not to say that, you know, the scores for these movies are bad scores, but they're just not, they don't resonate, and they don't elevate the material. And I think it's something that separates them, and I think it's obvious. And as someone who is just obsessed with music and soundtracks, it's clear to me that, you know, the soundtrack is just kind of like an afterthought for them. You know, where, you know, if you look in, not look into it, but if you look at any of kind of like the behind the scenes stuff for any of the Dark Knight movies, you know, Hans Zimmer is there when Chris Nolan is putting this movie together. It's not just oh, okay, well, the movie's all cut together, so we just got to find somebody to, you know, throw some music on, and then, you know, we'll put it out. So, I mean, I think it is incredibly, incredibly important, and it's something that I'd like to see Marvel Studios take a more active and interested hand in going forward. And I think it can help their movies. I don't think it's going to alienate, you know, the films from kind of like the mainstream audience that they're looking to cater to. But there's something about it. It's just difficult to explain. But I mean, there are just some movies have that music, and it just makes them for you. I mean, I'm always humming film scores just around the house, my poor wife, but, you know, I'm always doing it, and I'm not humming anything that I'm seeing or that I'm hearing in these Marvel films. And I want to feel that passion. I want to feel passionately about those movies on those, you know, kind of on those grounds.
Yeah, man. I mean, God almighty. Like I said, we could talk about this all day long. I have a friend who lives in New England who used to write for a magazine that only dealt with film scores.
Oh, wow.
And me and him used to have these conversations. And one of these days, I guess we could do an episode and somehow figure out a way to splice in music where we could just talk about our favorite scores and talk about the scenes that they're in. I think that would be a great episode of The Two Brandon.
Yeah, that would be fun. Be a lot of fun.
There's some stuff I want to talk about, but it doesn't make any sense unless you can hear
right, it. Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, it's one of those things that's hard to describe, but it's important. It's important. So, I think that's probably all for this installment, guys.
Yeah, we talked a lot today.
Yeah, we did. More than I was expecting. That always happens. I should just stop expecting anything. So go see Iron Man 3. Make up your own mind about it. There's stuff to like. There's stuff to dislike. If you want to see Oblivion, please do it on the big screen. Because that's the way to see it. It's a beautiful, beautiful picture. And pay attention to the music cues, kids. I mean, it's important. And there that's it. We'll see you guys next time. All right. This has been The Two Brandons. And thank you for listening. Thank you for supporting the podcast. And we'll be back real soon. All right. Peace.
Take care.